Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. This is the time where we see the cute stories separated from the real championship contenders. It's the conference finals round of the NBA playoffs, the NBA's Final Four. I'm pretty juiced up. How about you?
Yeah, man. Here we go. The wheat has been separated from the chaff, whatever that expression is.
Don't think that was it, but keep going.
The cream rises to the top. Marcus Smart and Terry Rozier are in the conference finals. It's time. This is the elitist basketball you've been waiting all year for.
It really is. And, you know, you mentioned the word elitist, so I'm just going to jump right on it. I mean, you look at this team, the Boston Celtics, and, you know, full credit to them. I mean, that was a very impressive Game 5 victory, and they, you know, pretty much controlled that entire series against Philadelphia. But I want to start by asking you a question. If we had a 1-16 playoff format, in other words, you know, it's all merit-based, it's not geography-based, do you think Boston would still have reached the Final Four of the NBA playoffs, or do you think that, you know, a team like Utah or someone else would have been able to knock them out? In other words, I love calling the West the show. I love calling East AAA. But is this a year where it's balanced, or would you consider Boston's success maybe propelled a little bit here by playing in a weaker conference?
You know, I think you're making a fair point, which is to say that had this Celtics team had to deal with Anthony Davis for the past 2 weeks, Anthony Davis and Jrue Holiday, the Pelicans were playing really well. Maybe New Orleans pushes them to seven. Maybe they beat them. I think the Jazz would have a really good shot in a series against these Celtics. But I think this gets to the heart of the weakness in your reseeding argument, okay? Because as a basketball fan, and I can't believe you're bringing this up here, I was all excited to talk about the conference finals, but we can go down this road for a few minutes if you want to. As a basketball fan, I really enjoyed that Sixers-Celtics series and the stakes for both sides. And even though I knew that, like, I was watching Terry Rozier and TJ McConnell, like, trade blows for half of these games, but despite the fact that that was clearly inferior to everything that was going on in the West, I think the East is every bit as entertaining and sometimes more so.
Well, I will say it was a very entertaining, hard-fought series. Lots of emotions. I loved Embiid just, you know, running straight into the Celtics fan base over and over again, never backing down even in defeat. You know, he doubled down by letting everyone know, hey, Ben Simmons told me we're going to win a bunch of rings during Game 5. It's like, oh, very cool story, Embiid. Way to, you know,
did he really say that?
Yeah, he did. He set the ceiling pretty high there for the future, but I hear what you're saying, but look, I got to stand up for our Open Floor Globe members in Delhi and Shanghai and, you know, the west coast of Ireland, your favorite place. I mean, we don't really care about this I-95 corridor, Andrew. I mean, that's all well and good, but come on, we want the best teams in the playoffs. I'm just asking the question, and you could say the same thing about Cleveland, frankly. You know, if they had to play, you know, in a 1-16 playoff format, do you think that they survive to the conference finals given how much they struggle with Indiana in round one? I'm just asking. I'm not telegraphing my answer. It's a rhetorical question where I'm trying to lead you a certain direction. Absolutely. I just want to put that out there.
It's very funny, though, because as much as you're a basketball elitist, I am still sort of an East Coast media elitist and or just East Coast person elitist. And I think that the intensity of Boston and Philly and all these cities who just kind of go crazy makes for really entertaining matchups. And I wouldn't want to lose that. Like, I think Boston-Utah may be slightly better basketball, but it would be a lot less fun. And this is probably the best argument yet. That Sixers-Celtics series is the best argument yet for not reseeding the playoffs.
Well, here's what I would say. The Golden State Warriors, for all of their light years talk, we haven't seen them helicopter a rapper out of jail to a game and have him sit courtside. We also haven't seen the Warriors bring a washed-up former quarterback 3,000 miles away across the country so that he can sling his wine on the podium after a series clinching victory. So we got to give it up for Boston and Philadelphia, really holding it down in terms of the intensity factor. Not even the Warriors can match that.
You know what? You were very upset about the Drew Bledsoe thing, and I think it has to do with geography, because I grew up in DC, but I have a bunch of family in New England. And so Drew Bledsoe was a big deal through like the first half of my childhood, and I loved having Drew Bledsoe like back in the mix randomly for the last 10 days and having him show up at the game. But you were very fired up about the Celtics bringing him to the podium last night, and I admit that was probably a step too far. But
just so rinky-dink, you know? I mean, look at Philadelphia. They're shooting off confetti for a tie. I mean, frankly, I think Brett Brown should have apologized to the Celtics for that after that happened. I mean, that was a real delay in the action and just a bad look for the organization. But then Boston come back, and they top it. I mean, the podium is supposed to be a sanctuary, you know, where we celebrate the victors and we – send on our condolences to the losers. And we've got Drew Bledsoe out there like coming up with Terry Rosé, some wine he's going to start selling.
I loved it.
Capitalize on this like month-long meme that Boston's been milking for 5 weeks. Just too much, Andrew. Come on.
I loved every second of it. I have been delighted to no end by the Terry Rozier experience, including Terry Rozier has the custom confetti shirt now, which is great. I don't know how he produced that so quickly. But listen.
Yeah, it must have been real tough. I'm sure his people don't have anything else going on. Come on, Andrew. You can print a t-shirt in 24 hours these days.
That's true. Look, Sixers Celtics was great. We're going to get to the Sixers toward the end. But right now, it's conference finals time. I'm going to start with a question that I have. And it's who can survive longer in these series? The Rockets or the Celtics? I'm curious.
That's pretty disrespectful framing, Andrew. I mean, if I'm a Celtics fan, I'm already mad at you. If I'm a Rockets fan, I'm already mad at you
for trying to say that
they're just going to be surviving. Oh, they're entering the conference finals on their deathbed? I didn't realize. Are you trying to cut off the oxygen, or what are you doing here?
If you're a Celtics fan, you are so far down the nobody believes in us wormhole that like you're praying that every single analyst picks the Cavs. And frankly, if I were a Rockets fan, I would be pretty thrilled to see the preponderance of experts out there who are now sort of shifting after a year of talking themselves into the Rockets. Most of the people I've seen have picked the Warriors. And I would feel good about that if I were a Houston fan too. So it's maybe disrespectful, but I think both fan bases are into it at this point.
The Houston fans not only have that bunker mentality of nobody believes in us, you know, we've never won a title with this group, can't get over the hump, but they also have the fact that they're the punchline of every joke about their crowd size and their intensity and how much they're into it, and they're going to come to the games late and they're going to leave early if they get down, and all of those things too, right? So like the true Rocket fans are absolutely like on 11 right now, and they've been waiting, you know, years for this moment. And so from that standpoint, I hear what you're saying, but I've got both teams, both the underdogs losing in six. How about you?
Oh, wow. So that's kind of a cop-out. I was really excited to try to pin you down to an actual prediction. I just
gave you two actual predictions.
I know.
Cleveland in six, Golden State in six. What more do you want from me?
I was asking for a real choice between the Rockets and Celtics. But you, look, that's a completely valid way to play it here.
So you want me to look up the calendar and see which date is later, the game six date?
we'll they survived longer.
They survived 24 hours longer.
Yeah. Yo, the NBA is really extending these series out. I cannot believe that game two of Rockets Warriors is Wednesday, and then game three is not until Sunday. But that is a separate point.
Well, it's not a surprise at all, because everybody hops on that first flight to San Francisco and then they just chill for like 72 hours. So I think that it wasn't a coincidence how that played out. I think everybody's excited with it.
Yeah, I'd like a nice weekend in San Francisco. I would say this as far as Rockets and Celtics. I really want to believe that the Rockets can make this interesting with the Warriors, but I'm just not there yet. I think the case for doubting the Warriors was that Steph wasn't going to be healthy, and he looks like 80% right now, maybe more, but at least 80, and that Draymond was not the same guy. And Draymond has been a monster over the last month, and he looks as great as ever. And if that's the case, then I just don't know how you match up if you're Houston. So I think this is going to go four or five games on Houston's side. And then I think the Celtics can actually push Cleveland, and that's a scary thing to say out loud because I've seen LeBron go into Boston and just like humiliate those guys repeatedly for the last couple of years. But the Cavs right now, I think we might be giving the Cavs a little too much credit for beating a Raptors team that A, almost lost to the Wizards, and B, crumpled psychologically like as soon as game one ended and happened the way it did. That team was kind of cooked. And I think offensively, this Boston team is on one of those weird runs where everything is clicking and everyone involved is punching above their weight class a little bit. And then defensively, the Celtics team is legitimately really, really good, and they're going to be a pain in the ass in a way that the Raptors couldn't be.
I'll get back to the Rockets in a second because I actually want to make a case for them rather than just a case against Golden State. But on this point about, you know, Toronto's mentality versus Boston's mentality, like, I don't know if you saw after game five, Brad Stevens had a great line. It really spoke to my heart. He says, you know, basically they were going to take today, which is Thursday, completely off. They were going to go out for a walk and, you know, catch their breath and have some time to reflect and think. And that got me thinking, imagine if after game one, where Toronto went 0 for 11 in that final stretch, and then they, you know, wind up losing in overtime. They just can't hit a shot. They're clearly in their own head. Imagine if instead of coming out on the postgame podium and saying, I think my team has the yips, I don't know what to do, guys, which is basically what Dwayne Casey said. What if he had just come out and said, look, we're not going to do anything tomorrow. We're all going to go take a walk. We're going to mentally cleanse. We're not going to focus on our loss. Because I can just picture all of those guys on that team and the coaching staff, like, not sleeping for 48 hours after that happened and thinking too much about the failure and allowing it to snowball. I wonder if they had taken the Brad Stevens, like, you know, yoga mantra approach of just like, step back, relax, you know, enjoy the sun. Maybe that would have helped them. Just something to think about, you know, Toronto Termites in future years. You should be advocating for a little bit of a mental break mid-series. But well, in terms of...
Yeah. And this is another case, we should add, of Brad Stevens slowly winning you over and turning you into a full-on Celtics believer, because there's nothing you can identify with more than the value of communing with nature. So shout out to Brad Stevens for really tugging on your heartstrings. And I think maybe eventually you're going to get there with Boston.
Yeah, I'll say this. You know, we had an email about me being a cult leader on the last episode. The real cult leader is Brad Stevens. I mean, it's unbelievable how deeply he's brainwashed everyone. And so much of our anti-Celtic sentiment can probably be chalked up to the fact that we realize we're being indoctrinated too. And we've just got to try to hang on to our mental freedom for as long as possible. But
he's so good. I don't blame anyone who's been brainwashed into joining the cult of Brad Stevens for the record.
No, there's definitely worse cults. There's no doubt. if we want to rank him, he's pretty high up there. But look, let me make the case for Houston here real quick, because what we've seen from the Rockets this season, they've won more games. They have a better point differential, and they have a higher offensive rating than any team Golden State has ever faced in the playoffs during the Steve Kerr era. That includes all the LeBron teams. It includes the Spurs with the healthy Kawhi Leonard. It includes that Thunder team that was really, really good in 2016. They've outperformed all of them. So I think for the people who want to just, like, you know, jump into that lazy narrative of, oh, well, Harden's probably going to fold, Chris Paul's probably going to fold, Golden State's too talented, it's going to be over. That may happen, but I don't think that's giving Houston nearly enough respect for what they've done this season. And we've seen some of those teams that I mentioned, whether it's Oklahoma City in 2016, whether it was Cleveland a couple times in the finals, where they have really made Golden State work. They've had to dig deep into their toolbox of counters and new lineups and adjustments and all of those things. I think Houston's going to be in a position to potentially do that too, but they have to start the series strong, right? Like, a split at home in games one and two isn't going to be enough. And I do think the Warriors are riding into that series with a lot of momentum. Basically, all their stars are playing pretty well. Like you mentioned, Draymond's been sensational. Kevin Durant's had a very good playoffs. I know you wrote about him. Steph Curry had a really strong game five, even though maybe he was a little bit up and down against New Orleans at times there. And then I think Klay's been, you know, steady as ever, you know, Klay Thompson, right? So if all their stars are playing well and there's not really you know, a weakness that you can kind of hone in on. That's what makes me default to Warriors in six. But I do think Houston is ready for this moment. I may live to regret saying that, but I also think that they're at the point where their body of work is so large, and even their postseason performance has been so professional in terms of how they put away two pretty good teams and how their defense has performed, you know, very consistently throughout this playoffs, that we have to take them seriously as a threat here.
Okay. Well, I agree with some of what you said. Let's talk through Rockets Warriors in a little bit more depth. We can come back to Cavs Celtics later on in the podcast. My number one reaction to what you just said was a flashback to you talking about the Raptors near the end of the season. It was on the podcast where we went in depth on the Raptors, and I came out the other side saying that the Raptors are this year's Hawks. And that was after you had run through all the stats about how Toronto was the toughest team that LeBron has faced in the East, and all of which was true based on their regular season. But I think that there's a similar dynamic at play in this series where Houston just doesn't totally have the horses. And I think a lot of it really comes down to Kevin Durant, obviously. I mean, if you're asking like Luke and Mbah Moute and Trevor Ariza to keep up with Durant, like that's going to be a really tough matchup to win. And also, though, I think another element of this is that the teams that you talked about that were able to beat the Warriors and really push them, at least, if you go back to that Thunder series, are teams that had like long rangy athletes who could make this team uncomfortable. And granted, Capella has been really good, and Mbah Moute will kind of play that role for Houston in this series. But like, that's a far cry from Kevin Durant in Oklahoma City, or even Tristan Thompson on Cleveland, and LeBron James defensively. Like, I think that Houston just doesn't have that front court athleticism that can kind of harass these guys. And absent that, it's going to be Houston trying to play a really similar game to what the Warriors are trying to do, except the Warriors have four Hall of Famers and Houston has two.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think the counter would be that Houston's a better three-point shooting team than Oklahoma City. Their offense is significantly more efficient than that Oklahoma City team was. They've got multiple playmaking, ball-handling threats to kind of, you know, push Golden State's defense a little bit harder than maybe some of those other teams push them. And yeah, that they're just basically all vets, and they've been really rolling and playing strong two-way basketball for months, right? They've got a lot of chemistry. They've got a lot of cohesion. They play for each other. You know, they cover up for each other's weaknesses. They've survived, you know, off-shooting nights from a Chris Paul or an off-shooting night from a James Harden. They've still found other ways to win basketball games. So there's a lot to like. But in terms of the individual matchups, yeah, like Kevin Durant, Stephen Curry are probably still the two best players in this series, right? And they're on the same team. And Draymond's the best defensive player on the court, and it's not even close, right? So they have a significant talent advantage. I'm just saying that Houston presents here as a very serious team. Now, Golden State looked in Game 5 to me like they were starting to flip that switch a little bit. I mean, obviously, they made a lot of headlines by going to the Hamptons 5, you know, starting lineup. And they've been bearing that pretty much all season long. Like, it wasn't their most used lineup this season. They haven't used it all that much in the playoffs overall, in part because Steph's been hurt. And then during the regular season, they never used it against Houston, right? And what we always expected, as soon as Houston added Chris Paul and they got those other wings, you know, PJ Tucker and, you know, being able to play him at the five, we expected like total interchangeable, right? And Golden State, when they played Houston during the regular season, they just masked it, Andrew. They never even used that lineup. So it does feel like it's secret weapon time for Golden State, and that could be what scares me if I'm a Rockets fan. It's like they haven't even played their best group against Houston yet this year, and those games during the regular season were pretty competitive and pretty interesting. So if you're able to keep it interesting with sort of one hand tied behind your own back because you don't want to reveal your secrets, that's what would scare me if I was a Houston fan.
Yeah, and it is, it's more than that even. It's not just the lineups. I mean, I think we were talking about this Warriors team all year, watching Draymond and watching like Iguodala, and just everybody was in kind of autopilot mode. And now everyone is engaged, and it sort of changes the dynamics a little bit. But you talked about defensive presences.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. I want to say here's one reason why I do think the lineup bit matters a lot, because so far during the postseason, when the Hamptons five have played together, they've outscored the Pelicans 165 to 111 in 54 minutes of action, right? So that's basically like a little bit more than a 48 game. They outscored New Orleans by 54 points in 54 minutes. Okay, that's ridiculous. So they're really, really clicking. And if you're Houston, you match up better with that group than New Orleans did. You absolutely do, because you do have more length than the Pelicans do. You have more explosive offensive players. You have more two-way guys than the Pelicans do. But you're still thinking you just got to try to keep it close during those minutes, because that's how explosive they are and that's how versatile they are defensively too.
Do you have a take on the Hamptons 5 nickname?
It's fine. I don't know. How about you?
I love it. I did not like Death Lineup all that much. I just thought it was kind of corny and was played out pretty quickly. But the Hamptons 5, it's just every time I hear that used, and now it's beginning to be used on like national broadcasts, which only makes it more hilarious. It's become legitimized all of a sudden. I think after Steve Kerr acknowledged it at a press conference during this Pelican series. But it just reminds me of how absurd that weekend was in general, because you go back, you had like Jay Crowder sitting there telling KD that the Celtics had cracked the code to the Warriors. You had Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan crammed into a hotel room with Steve Ballmer. There was like Tom Brady was, I think, sending pictures to Durant, or Brady was involved somehow. David Ortiz was in the mix. It was great.
What about Drew Bledsoe? Was he in there too?
I don't think Bledsoe made the cut. It was before his comeback, his return to the public spotlight.
You know, Drew Bledsoe sitting there during the Eastern Conference Finals like, oh, now they want me, you know? I was there. Yeah. I was ready to be the KD closer. No, the reason why I do like the Hamptons 5 nickname, though, is because, you know, I've heard a lot of analysts out there and, you know, guys just kind of dismiss Kevin Durant maybe as a role player, and they say other negative things about him. Why they do this, I don't know. They love to attack his character, but the Hamptons 5 does. Yeah, it probably is. You know, it's just misguided jealousy. But the Hamptons 5 nickname is a reminder that the whole thing is built around KD. You know, he's their best all-around two-way player.
You're ruining it now.
They all went to the Hamptons to recruit him. You know, I don't remember any recruiting trip for Steph Curry to re-sign this summer. So, yeah, it is nice to have KD right smack dab in the mix. Because I would say, of everybody in this postseason, besides LeBron, KD's had the best postseason.
He has. He also has not had a difficult matchup yet. And I think that's part of the thing with the Warriors, is they are so good at seeking out mismatches. And it's part of what has made them so dominant over the last 3 or 4 years, in addition to the defense and Steph and literally everything. You could pick out 5 different things that the Warriors are the best at. But one of the things that they're great at is being very disciplined about finding the mismatch on the court and just exploiting it over and over again. And
come
Kevin
on, Andrew.
Durant.
Give this guy his credit. There's a reason why he hasn't had a tough mismatch. It's because he's unbelievable. Has LeBron had a tough mismatch?
Fair.
You know, Bojan and DeMar DeRozan sitting in the fourth quarter. Now we're supposed to call that a tough mismatch? No. Like, Kevin Durant doesn't have a good matchup because he's like 7 foot. He can pull up from 5 feet behind the 3-point line. He can take you off the dribble. He can play 4 and 5 defensively. He can cover ground in the pick and roll. He can do it all.
Look, I'm not going to argue with you. He's completely unguardable, and you're right that he deserves a lot of credit for that. I just think he becomes even more unguardable, if that's possible, when you can't double him because he's passing to Steph or Clay or hitting Draymond with a 4-on-3 and allowing Draymond to go steamrolling down the lane and to find someone for a layup. Like, it's just really tough at that point. And then if it's single coverage with KD, you're right. He's the most unstoppable offensive player on the planet. So I wish, as someone who loves his game, I do wish that he were in a situation that allowed me to appreciate it a little bit more, because he is amazing. But look, we don't have to get into the KD argument yet. We'll probably have plenty of Warriors blowouts in which we could discuss that. Let's talk about the length, though. You mentioned Houston has a little bit of a better matchup with Golden State. I think a huge part of this series comes down to Clint Capela. And we got a question from Joel Neer, who said, What do you think of Clint Capela compared to Rudy Gobert? Gobert was a net negative in every game against Houston, while Capela was constantly a positive mark for the Rockets. Gobert did bring down OKC, but I see Gobert's abilities as a little bit less scalable than Clint Capela. So I think there should be an asterisk next to that, next to the plus minus for both those guys in that series, because Gobert was on the perimeter having to deal with Chris Paul and James Harden, whereas like Capela was out there with Donovan Mitchell, who is great, but is not really the same type of step-back shooter kind of assassin that CP3 and Harden have been. What do you think of Capela's chances in this series?
No, it's a good point about the single game plus minus. You got to be careful of that. It's much more reliable when you look at plus minus over large sample sizes. Single game plus minus, Andrew, it's pretty helpful. Like when a guy like Rodney Hood just basically goes on strike in the middle of the second quarter and he puts up like a minus 26 in 12 minutes, that's how you could really isolate in on one guy not having a good night. In the scenario where like you're talking about two centers who are not like primary offensive options for their teams, their plus minus is going to be dictated in part by how well the players around them play. And when, in Houston's case, they have a lot more talent on that roster. And so you would expect Capela's plus minus to look better than Gobert's. That being said, don't take anything away from Capela. He has been one of the breakout stars of this postseason. If he played for Boston, he'd probably already have a statue outside TD Garden in terms of the hype factor. And I think the Rockets fans were banging their chest before that Jazz series saying, watch what this guy is going to do to Gobert. And they were right. I mean, he, arguably won that matchup, and he has been a perfect fit for what they're trying to do both ways. He's very skilled defensively, and he's going to make for some interesting situations, because if Golden State does go small and, you know, Draymond's not hitting his threes, you know, you can probably keep Capela on the court. Now, if Draymond's shooting, that could force a situation where Houston has to turn to Tucker more as their sort of center option. And that's where I really get worried about the Durant factor, because when Houston goes to its small lineup, that's when Durant's length and his one-on-one ability is really going to pop, because you don't have, you know, shot blockers coming across the paint to help on him. It's just going to be a kind of a funnel to the basket. So keeping Capela on the court to me is going to be a huge, you know, X factor for Houston in terms of like strategy. And I think, you know, as Golden State maybe feels out the Rockets a little bit early in the series, I wouldn't be surprised if they start big just to kind of like, you know, see what's up with, how everyone's going to play. But in my ideal world, this series goes small very quickly and stays small. And I'm actually kind of excited to see how small it can go, because I think, you know, if you're Houston, you have to keep your shooters on the court as often as possible and as efficient as Capela has been, you know, offensively for them, in terms of just being that constant lob threat. You know, that's not as dangerous as having 5 3-point shooters on the court. So he's going to play a very important role in this series. I think if Houston's going to pull the upset, we're going to look back and say, wow, like Capela had an unbelievable series. If they go down, it will probably be because either, you know, Capela's neutralized or Houston just can't keep him on the court.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, if you're a Houston fan, like, you need Capela on the court to have a chance, and you need him to be playable. And we'll see. I am not particularly bullish on his chances in this series, because I think, like, again, dealing with guys like Draymond and Durant is a whole different ballgame. I am interested. Did you see that there's a rumor that the Suns are going to try to offer him a max deal over the summer?
Sounds perfect. No, I mean, hey, he's really good.
He's good.
I think he deserves to get a big time payday. I mean, I don't know if he's your like franchise number one guy. Like, he would probably have to be at Houston or in Phoenix. You know, he'd be their highest paid player, right?
Yeah.
That's probably not a recipe for success. But on that point, Andrew, I wanted to ask you a Capela question. And, you know, I was trying to rope you into some arguments earlier. That didn't work. So I'm going to take a softer tone here. And hey, Andrew, I have a question for you.
Hit me.
After the game in January, Houston beats Golden State. Capela goes to the media and says, we're the better team. You know, we have the weapons to beat these guys. Beating them during the regular season was good for Houston swag. I mean, he really kind of laid it on thick.
Yeah.
The next day, Kevin Durant channeled not only John Wall, but he also channeled sort of blog boys everywhere by saying, look, you know, it's easy for Capella to say that because he has an easy job. He just gets spoon-fed all day long. He's not really, you know, that important to his team. And really dug back at Capella. So I'm just interested in your take on this back and forth. Like, is this going to all blow up in Capella's face? Is he going to get the last laugh here? Is it all going to be much ado about nothing once Draymond enters the trash-talking phase and really goes after the Rockets? Or are we going to be seeing those quotes come back to bite him?
Well, if there's one thing that we have learned about Kevin Durant, it's that self-awareness is not really a specialty of his.
And so true.
I thought in the moment I was taken aback that he would respond that way, because he's been spoon-fed his fair share of buckets. Ooh. In Golden State the last few years. As far as the Capella side of this, I don't think he's famous enough to have any of this matter. So, like, I think even literally as you were talking, I was like, oh man, we're spending too much time on Capella. I don't think anyone really cares about Clint Capella in this series. I don't think that his quotes are going to be an ongoing storyline. Although, you know, look, he's going to be a max player this summer. So I would love to have a Clint Capella controversy in this series, but I'm not sure we're going to get there. And I think my favorite thing that you've said is that the Warriors are going to go big to start the series, in part just to sort of lull the Rockets into a false sense of security and see how much they can win playing a more traditional style. And again, save that kind of Hamptons 5 look for when it really matters or when they want to blow these guys off the court. I think that's probably how they'll play it.
Yeah, for sure. And the reason I brought it up too is, I don't know if you saw Draymond and Steph on the podium. They were having a lot of yucks at Clint Capella's expense. I mean, you know, Steph was like, "What'd he say?" And like Draymond's like, "You know, that's all fine and dandy in January. Now you've got to play us. We've got them. They've got us." You know, and Draymond really set the tone for this series. And from a trash talking perspective, I thought, I mean, essentially saying, "Look, like, it's cool, Houston. You know, Daryl Morey, you go around telling everyone that you're obsessed with us. Like, we don't really think about you. We've won two titles in 3 years. Basically, who are you?" I mean, he was really doing the little brother act, you know, towards the Rockets. And I mean, think about it, Andrew. You're Chris Paul. How do you feel hearing those words? I mean, first of all, you're probably not super happy that Daryl Morey came out and told everyone that you're obsessed with the Warriors. I mean, it's a little awkward thing
It's the Raptors' problem. You don't want to give them that much power.
Yeah, great point. But imagine you're Chris Paul and now you're hearing the volleys come back and Draymond's, you know, brushing you off again. I mean, doesn't that get under your skin? Like, aren't you a little extra fired up for game one because of that?
Yeah, I mean, Chris Paul is like a full-blown maniac in the playoffs and has been for 10 years. So I don't think he needs the extra motivation. Maybe James Harden will, and that's actually a good segue to our last talking point on this series before things get started. Thaddeus says, "I think that when people say Harden chokes in big games," in quotes, that's a talking head thing that misses the point entirely. If you look back historically, what's actually happening is there's something about him, more than most superstars, where he gets worse as a series goes longer. I don't know whether it's him wearing down, his coaches, or him not making adjustments, or other teams simply learning how to cut his efficiency after a few games. But this is a real trend. Even looking at what just happened in the Utah series, look at games 4 and 5. Games 4, he had 24-4-3 on 36% shooting and 14% from 3. Game 5, he had 18-4, again on 32% shooting and 14% from 3, and only 4 free throw attempts. So I think it's a good point. And then Thaddeus, who always emails us these long emails full of stats, which make for really bad radio.
Thaddeus is the man, though.
He is.
Thaddeus, keep emailing. You're doing great.
Please do. But I won't read through the rest of the stats. But there are other series where the same thing has happened. So how real is this phenomenon? And do you think that's kind of what the choking thing is all about?
Well, I had a little bit of a different take on sort of what was happening in that Utah series. Didn't you tell me a while ago that sometimes the Rockets feel kind of like a video game to you? They're not that interesting because it's sort of like programmed. I mean, isn't that sort of an analogy you've used before?
Yeah. What the precise analogy is that there was in every video game, every football video game, there's one play where you all you have to do is make one or two simple reads and somebody's going to be wide open. And that's how the Rockets have played offense all year long. And I didn't say that to denigrate them, because I think it's amazing that they can do that and score over and over again and make teams look completely helpless. But that's what they're doing.
So I'm going to run with this analogy. So I think last year during the playoffs, you know, the video game was backfiring. They were trying to run their play and it wasn't working. And they were at the point where they're just like yanking their controller out of the wall and like, you know, restarting the whole console and nothing's yeah. working. And finally, they're just like breaking the flat screen TV and then they're out of the playoffs. Right.
Right.
It was amazing because I did an interview with Daryl Morey over the summer, and it was like right after they had traded for Chris Paul. And I sort of asked him about like the importance of Paul on their offense, trying to find the balance, you know, exploring the mid-range more, staggering the minutes, like all the strategic stuff. And Morey lays it all out for me. Here's our vision. And during games 4 and 5 against Utah, that vision came to reality perfectly. It was like he had sort of reprogrammed the video game and like, you know, blew on the little Nintendo cartridge and plugged it back in, and all of a sudden it's working like it's supposed to. Because Chris Paul, as James Harden is going through some shooting struggles, Chris Paul's going nuts, Andrew. He had 9 mid-range jumpers in game 5 to ice the Jazz. So I was not coming away from game 5 saying, oh, wow, Harden does it again. And I, by the way, he was supposedly sick, according to Mike D'Antoni. But my takeaway was, wow, they have a really, really effective and ruthless backup plan on their offense if Harden's not clicking at A-plus levels. I mean, Chris Paul was just torching them, and not only with his own scoring, but with his distribution, with his ball control, no turnovers in that game. I believe he had 10 assists. I mean, it was an incredible all-around performance in a closeout game, especially for a guy who's, you know, trying to break through to the conference finals for the first time. So
it was awesome.
I guess this is a long way of saying I'm not as worried about Harden faltering as I was last year, because mm-hmm. last year there was no backup plan. Like if he faltered, or if he got into that, you know, Warriors series, similar to, you know, the Western Conference Finals a couple of years ago, once they took away Harden, once he started to have these shooting struggles as the series progressed, as Thaddeus is pointing out, it was just over. Like, there was no other hope. And I don't enter this series with quite that same feeling. I think Houston is going to be able to play the chess match game a little bit more if Harden's not really, really rolling. But I also think people hold him to a really high standard because of his past baggage.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, 24 points on not a bad shooting night. I mean, that's okay. That's a C. You know, that's not an F. And I think from that standpoint, we should try to dig a little deeper when we're looking for ways that Houston can lose and not just make this into a, you know, a slam Harden fest, which I think is, you know, a very common approach, you know, among a lot of analysts and fans.
Yeah, I hear you. I also think that there is a movement among the smarter basketball set and the sort of like NBA Twitter hive to kind of minimize some of the failures. Like Harden has had a couple F's, and even after Chris Paul had that game the other night, which was amazing, and I've loved Chris Paul for 10 years. You can go back and read stuff I wrote on Grantland about Chris Paul. Like, he's amazing. But he's had some really inexplicable meltdowns over the years, particularly that OKC game, but he also blew a Grizzlies series in there, and like he's had some rough moments in the playoffs. And so after he had that game against Utah the other night, there were a lot of people pounding their chest, talking about how like the idea that Chris Paul has had struggles in the playoffs and isn't clutch was always a lie. And I don't think that's true either. I think that like Harden, and it shortchanges a potential breakthrough from both of them if we act like there haven't been issues in the past. So I am really excited to see what they can do in this series. And like, if you go back to those 12 hours where I talked myself into the Rockets as the favorites or picked them to win, that was all predicated on loving Chris Paul and thinking that he is due for a Hall of Fame stretch here along the lines of like Dirk Nowitzki in the 2011 playoffs, where he just kind of blows everyone's minds, and we turn around after this is all over with and start talking about Chris Paul as one of the best point guards of all time, one of the best players of all time. But that his ability to do that is predicated on Harden showing up and giving them 25 to 30 a game at least. And I'll be interested to see whether he can do that.
No, that's well said. And let's also put that whole conference finals knock on Chris Paul into context. If he's playing in the Eastern Conference and going up against, you know, Lance Stephenson and, you know, Kyle Lowry tripping all over himself, I'm going to wager that Chris Paul would have made the conference finals at some point. But yes, you're right. I mean, he has had some spectacular failures and so has Harden. But I think that those guys wind up being defined by their worst 10% of their playoff games rather than their whole body of work. And I understand that. I mean, especially in high pressure moments where you're losing
that's just
a series.
The way this works.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, let me flip this around. Did you look at Chris Paul differently after that game five performance where he finally breaks through? I mean, the Jazz were solid. They weren't great. You know, they kind of got a lucky draw in terms of, you know, they earned the number one seed. They didn't have to face, you know, the toughest teams in the world in the West. They didn't have to get through San Antonio, you know, with Kawhi Leonard or anything like that. They knocked off two kind of plucky upstarts, and now they're in the conference finals. Like, was that the greatest accomplishment of Chris Paul's career? You know, do you look at him differently? I mean, didn't that game seven game winner against San Antonio in the first round a couple years ago, wasn't that more impressive? And so I do think it's just a little too simplistic when we bash on these guys. But look, if they choke again, we're going to bash them. That's the job.
Well, that's the thing. That game seven win against the Spurs was amazing. And to answer your question, no, I didn't look at Chris Paul differently, but I reacted the exact same way I did in that year against the Spurs. It's like to say, okay, let's keep it moving. Let's keep this going. No more meltdowns. And then fast forward 2 weeks in 2014, and the Clippers were melting down against the Rockets, and it was one of the more inexplicable things I've ever seen on a basketball court. And I just hope that doesn't happen with Chris Paul, because he is so good, and he deserves better than the legacy that would come with another meltdown here. But
you sound so worried he's going to melt down, Andrew. It's just seeping through the microphone airwaves right now.
You know what? Look, you mentioned the East. Let's keep it moving and move over to the Eastern Conference. But before we do, Ben, tell us about this time of year.
It's a wonderful, wonderful time of year that brings us two things, Andrew. Graduations and Father's Day, dads and grads, and the gifts that go along with them. Before you buy dad another tie or that grad a balloon that will probably just float away, Andrew, you need to ask yourself this. Does my dad or grad, does your dad or grad like wings or sports, or better yet, both? If the answer is yes, then I have a great solution for you, Andrew. Do you know what it is?
No, what is it? Hit me.
A Buffalo Wild Wings gift card. That's right, a gift card to Buffalo Wild Wings.
I love it. Well, right now, if you purchase $30 worth or more in-store or online, Buffalo Wild Wings will give you a $5 bonus to keep for yourself. That's a gift that gives back. How generous of you. So check it out. Hook up your dad. Hook up your grad friend, your brother, whoever. Brother or sister, you know, no gender. This is gender neutral. Everyone can eat wings. Get in there, though.
Thank you very much, Andrew, for clarifying. There's no gender restrictions on wing eating at Buffalo Wild Wings. No, I did notice, though, Andrew, with this ad, it's Mother's Day on Sunday, right? So they're just bypassing the Mother's Day target. And I actually think that they're concerned that our listeners, just based on the tone of this ad, they're concerned that our listeners have already forgotten about mom and they're more focused on dad. And the real thing that they're focused on is themselves because of this whole thing with, you know, spend 30, get five for yourself. So, you know, Buffalo Wild Wings, like, we don't have completely selfish and chauvinistic listeners, okay? If you want to buy a Buffalo Wild Wings gift card for mom for Mother's Day, you know, spend $30, get five for yourself, do it again for dad. All of a sudden, you've got $10. Think about how many amazing wings you could buy with that free $10. Andrew, Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports, terms and conditions do apply as they always do.
Well, look, to keep it moving and keep it topical, I had to cancel Mother's Day plans with my mom this morning because I'm going up to Boston for game one of Cavs Celtics. And maybe I should get her a Buffalo Wild Wings gift card to make it up to her.
So did Buffalo Wild Wings didn't charge to cancel your reservation, though, did they?
No, she didn't. That did not happen, but who knows? We'll see. Let's keep it moving, though. David says, is there any chance Kyrie could return for the finals if the Celtics advance? What about Hayward? Even if they're just coming off the bench, they could help the second unit. That is not going to happen. Kyrie is out for good. The only reason I included this, though, is because I really, really miss Kyrie. And he would have made the Celtics-Sixers series so much more fun. And God, he would make this Cavs series so much more fun.
Yeah, it really spoils the conference finals. I mean, they can't come back. Hayward's got a video game tournament. Kyrie got some paper clips taken out of his knees. So I don't see either one of those things happening. But it is too bad. I mean, the Celtics at full strength in this series, let me just put it to you, would they be favored? I mean, given you're adding two all-star level players to a team that's been rock solid, steady throughout the postseason, maybe not spectacular, but certainly strong and definitely smart and savvy defensively. You would really need Hayward to guard LeBron potentially, and then Kyrie's scoring ability would boost up the ceiling of Boston's offense and really force Cleveland secondary guys to show up, or I think the Cavaliers would lose. I mean, I could see a situation where if they had been full strength for this series that they would enter that series as favorites, especially with home court.
Yeah, I think unquestionably they would be the favorites. And I was thinking about this the other day. What is ultimately going to make this Boston team so, so scary when they're at full strength next year is the ability of Brad Stevens to just stagger these guys for 48 minutes. And like, you're never going to be out. You're never going to watch the Celtics without two like great scorers out there, because I think that's sort of where Tatum is headed and maybe already is. And Jaylen Brown is close, and as a 3-point shooter has gotten much, much better even over the last couple months. And like, they're just going to be really, really scary. And I was thinking about that with the Sixers too. Like when Boston went five out and tried to draw Embiid away from the hoop, most of the time they were trying to do that with Marcus Morris and Aaron Baines, who both played well, Aaron Baines more so than Marcus Morris. But like, once you're doing that with Gordon Hayward and Jaylen Brown, like, I don't know how you guard that if you're Joel Embiid. Like, it's just going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, if Boston's at full strength and Horford's still winning the matchup one-on-one with Embiid, forget it. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? You're in big trouble if you're Philly. So that's why they need to go out there and get Kawhi, Paul George, and LeBron. Then they're going to be fine.
Yeah, they'll be fine. We're not worried about the process. Byron says, it's crazy how quickly everything changes in the playoffs. 10 days ago, I was saying, please, LeBron, just lose to the Raptors, so you don't have to lose to the Sixers in the Eastern Conference. And that way you can join the process next year. And now it's, so if the Warriors get tired from a 7-game series with Houston, don't the Cavs have a little bit of a chance in the finals? What's your reaction to this and where we are with LeBron right now?
Well, I think what really tipped everything was Philly coming hard back to earth, right? I mean, I think that was the biggest surprise, I guess, of the second round, because everything else played out pretty much according to form, right? The favorites, in most cases, I mean, Toronto falling to pieces. I mean, once game one happened, you kind of knew where that was going. So right. I think the Philly part of it was the most surprising. I'm still curious now that it's over. I mean, what are your takeaways on, Philly, the way they lost? I mean, how disappointing is it? How worried are you about their star guys? I mean, based on the series, like, I mean, would you still view their season as sort of an A+? Because I think, if you're looking at it from 10,000 feet and you don't really have a dog in the fight, you say they completely surpassed expectations. They're young. Their guys stayed healthy for the most part, besides a fluky face injury for Embiid late in the season. They won a playoff series and they got the reps in the second round. And if, some of their role guys had shown up, they could have easily won that series. So that seems like an A+ season, right?
Right.
But it didn't really feel like an A+ after game five, did it?
Yeah. I mean, look, we had a question from Joey who asked basically exactly that, and whether this is a letdown or whether it's a step forward. And I don't know. I really think it's both. Like you said, the easy take is to step back and say, oh, no, come on. Like, it didn't end the way they wanted it to, but this season was a huge step forward for everything the Sixers are trying to do, et cetera, et cetera. And, like, I think that's true to a point, but I don't know. I think it's a success insofar as the final 2 months – gave these guys proof of concept. Like, this can definitely work. Simmons and Embiid are monsters, and when everything clicks in Philadelphia, it's terrifying, and they can run teams off the floor. And Embiid is awesome on defense, and it, you know, again, like, they spent the final 6 weeks of the season looking like the future of the NBA, but this Boston series was a winnable series, and it certainly should have gone longer than five games if you're the Sixers. And I think failing to call this a disappointment and or letdown and or disaster ultimately will make it harder for them to make progress over the long term. I think everybody involved in Philadelphia kind of has to, like, recognize that this was pretty bad. I mean, the Embiid and Simmons were both super disappointing. Brett Brown got badly outcoached, and the role players didn't show up. So it's not great.
Yeah, I hear you. So in terms of the question, though, about Cleveland, I don't see any way where they can compete with Golden State. You know, I think even with a, you know, out of this world LeBron, you know, 40-point triple-doubles and all of that, like, I just think Golden State's too deep, too talented, too explosive. So, you know, in that theoretical finals matchup, you know, I'm looking forward to it because I love the historical aspect of it. I love the idea of LeBron against these great teams, but I think that would be quick. But let's focus more on the Eastern Conference Finals with Cleveland. Well, because
wait, let's go back to the Sixers for a second.
My natural inclination is to ease up a little bit, to step out of that moment of disappointment. But as you watched their late game plays, especially, it just, the thought that was going through my mind over and over again is like, guys, you're better than this. Like, you shouldn't be doing this. You're shooting yourself in the foot time and time again. And I think that's a frustrating part because they didn't always look like a young team, like, you know, a chicken with its head cut off, like they didn't belong. Like, they were out there, they were playing, like they had made the transition, but they had some really egregious mistakes in many late game scenarios. I mean, even in game five, where, you know, Embiid is going one-on-one, forcing a tough shot, not getting the foul call, ball goes off of him. You know, there's just other scenarios where, you know, possessions are winding up empty where they had to score, or, you know, they're having defensive breakdowns and letting, you know, easy shots, you know, happen around the rim. Or in Embiid's case, he's just getting tired and not competing for defensive rebounds at key situations. And, you know, Boston's able to pound the glass. I mean, all these things where if you expect a guy to step up and really be like the best center since Shaq, right? And that's Embiid's standing in that. He did not play that series like it. You know, he had some good numbers. He had some big performances. Boston did a spectacular job defending him. But he didn't have the level of presence that I thought he would. And then with Simmons, you know, the mistakes in Philly, I think, you know, late is really what cost him his series in terms of being able to walk away from it and feeling really, really good about it. Now, I did like how they kind of regrouped themselves in the immediate aftermath. I mean, they didn't seem completely shattered by it. They also didn't have the deer in the headlights look. Like, they seemed like they had a real thoughtfulness to them. You know, Brett Brown was saying, look, we measure ourselves by the standard the Celtics set. I think that's a really smart thing for teams that were both going through rebuilding cycles, you know, kind of in parallel, with Boston a little bit ahead of them on the curve. I think that's a, you know, it's smart for Philly to set Boston as their target. But certainly they can take a lot of lessons from this series. And you probably saw Donovan Mitchell. He told the reporters after losing to the Rockets that he planned to go back and watch like every single game from his rookie year during the summer to like prepare for next season. And I mean, I don't know if the Sixers have to do that, but I think if they really poured over that tape of the second round series against Boston, they would find like 50 things that they could correct or that they would have done differently. And, you know, I think that's sort of what makes them scary, is they have enough talent to make those adjustments going forward. And I think they just didn't have the knowledge base in the moment to get it done.
Yeah, I think you're right. And they should feel good about everything they accomplished this year, obviously, because they were able to transcend 4 or 5 years of mediocrity and or just straight up awfulness. And I think it's incredible, and it's a testament to how good Simmons and Embiid are. But speaking strictly, I'm coming at this as a Wizards fan who has had to sit here and watch the Wizards kind of like explain away all kinds of playoff letdowns over the years. And there's always good reasons for some of the second round losses that Washington has had. And that's just not how like the best teams in the league conduct themselves. And I want Philly to fall closer to the like Boston, Golden State, San Antonio spectrum, as opposed to the Wizards side of the spectrum. So that's the only reason I would say that everyone should be a lot more concerned than some people have been.
Yeah, well, the longer that we're talking about this, actually, I'm going the opposite way. I'm actually feeling more positive for Philly because I'm thinking back to the start of the season, and it was like, I mean, you were a little bit nervous about Brett Brown's future there.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
You got into a fist fight with Ben Simmons at training camp over whether or not he was a point guard. We were totally convinced Embiid was going to play like 45 games, and you know, all of those things went the other way.
You know,
like Brett Brown's like
Very
a legit
true.
Coach of the Year candidate. Simmons will most likely win Rookie of the Year. Embiid is, you know, all NBA, probably second team center, and they won a playoff series. If you had told me that in September, I would have been stunned, you know, pleasantly, you know, stunned, but stunned. So I guess I am coming around to like the moral victory side of things, even though as you watched it unfold, you were like, come on, guys, just don't do that.
Yeah, it's very out of character for you, but I am glad. I want to talk a little bit more about the Simmons side of it, okay? Henry said, I'm having trouble gauging the appropriate level of panic after Ben Simmons' playoff performances. Given the future Hall of Famer narrative, it feels wrong to not worry at all, but it also feels wrong to react to a kid or to overreact to a kid shrinking in round two of an intense series. What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on Simmons right now?
Well, I'm not sure it's a narrative. I think he's just going to be a future Hall of Famer. I mean, he's really, really good. And remember, he got slowed down by all defensive level player in Al Horford. You know, Boston, when they were game planning for Philly, I mean, they clearly made a priority early in that series. Like, we're going to put our smartest, most veteran, most tested, most versatile defender on Simmons and try to make his life difficult and throw him for a loop, right?
Yeah.
That's the ultimate sign of respect. And this is year one for him. I mean, if you go back a couple of years for the first time Giannis was in the playoffs, I mean, remember, he was like, you know, trucking Mike Dunleavy into the fifth row because he
that's
like
a
couldn't,
really good point. Yeah,
he couldn't control his emotions, and Simmons is out here putting up triple doubles you know, against Miami and still having some, you know, quality moments against Boston. And it was just kind of the situation where like their defense was so ready for him, and only occasionally was he able to unlock it, like in kind of LeBron-like fashion, and really get up ahead of steam in the half court and go to the basket and finish with the dunk or get a really high percentage look. Like, he is going to be able to, you know, review this series and say, hey, here's what worked, and I'm going to do that more. And I think he's going to be, you know, just fine next season. I meant it when I said it the other week, by the way. I think he's going to be a starter on next year's All-Star team. I think he's going to have the fan vote. I think he's just going to be that level of a profile, you know, given this momentum they've generated basically since the All-Star break this year.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's, you know, if you're buying stock in Simmons Inc., like, you know, keep buying it. Like, he is headed for a real ramp up here in the next 12 months.
Yeah, I think I disagree to some extent. I obviously he has a really bright future, but what concerns me is he's just so far away on the jumper that it seems unrealistic that he's ever going to get there. I mean, people are talking about shooting with a different hand, and we went through this with Tristan Thompson like 8 years ago, which if Tristan Thompson is the comp for your offensive game, like, that's not great. And I think, or at least as a shooter. And as far as his performance in this series, like, I think you're right that they did a lot of things well, Boston did, to take him out of his game. But he also, I didn't like how he kind of just checked out. Like, he wasn't very useful defensively either, and he wasn't useful off the ball and didn't really know how to play. And I guess I agree with you that he's going to be great no matter what. There is just no way. He's too good at too many things to not be a superstar in the NBA. What would concern me if I were a Philly fan is that there just really wasn't any chemistry between Simmons and Embiid in this series. And that's going to be something to watch, because like the place where the Sixers lost that game in game five was when the fourth quarter started. Simmons was out there and they were actually playing pretty well. And then they brought Embiid in, and everything started running through Embiid. Simmons looked discombobulated for the next 5 or 6 minutes, and it just didn't work. And I think Simmons, his game works as a point guard, but I also think that he could work as like a five who just terrorizes people from the post, and he doesn't want to play that way, and he can't play that way when Embiid is in there. So like, there's a lot that Philly is going to have to figure out to make this work.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're underselling the role that Boston's defense played here a little bit, because how many other teams in the Eastern Conference are going to be able to successfully take away Embiid around the basket, which Boston did? I mean, Baines and Horford did a really nice job of making Embiid work, tiring him out, playing defense without fouling, and then, you know, making him settle for jumpers basically all over the court and, you know, taking advantage of his fatigue late in games. Like, they did an exceptional job with that. And then Boston also has got pretty good personnel to, you know, deploy on Simmons and to make his life difficult too. You know, it's sort of like we always say, like, what's the best way to slow down a LeBron team? Well, you have to have those big physical wing defenders, and you have to have a, you know, a rim protecting presence. Like, that's the formula. If the team doesn't have both of those things, he's probably going to win the series. Mm-hmm. I think that's essentially a similar formula in terms of trying to slow down the Sixers, and Boston's just one of the few teams that had, you know, good enough defenders to be able to do both of those things. Now, we will see that theory tested in the conference finals, because LeBron has shown that he is significantly better than Boston's personnel. They don't have the level of physicality needed to kind of make him work on the perimeter. And then Horford and, you know, their other interior defenders in the past have just not been able to take away the basket area or the free throw line from LeBron. And so we'll see. But I think, you know, for now, I'm not in panic mode with Simmons. I think, you know, a lot of what they struggled with, both him and Embiid in this series, was directly attributable to what Boston was doing.
Yeah, and directly attributable to youth, which is part of it too. The one thing I would add on the Embiid side is when he came off the bench in the fourth quarter, like I said, it was just disastrous and really frustrating. And he had a number of frustrating turnovers last night, and defensively, it was not a great series for him. But Embiid in that third quarter was incredible. And that was like, there were 8 minutes there where he did look like Shaq, and he lived up to all the hype that we've heard all year. And if he can be that player going forward, it's going to be really scary. And I think that's what everyone should be rooting for. So we'll see if he can get there. He needs to get in better shape and needs to sort of clean up some of the bullshit with the turnovers and the passing and everything else. But I think, you know, it was nice to be reminded why we've spent so much time worshiping this dude.
Yeah, they need to start working the refs earlier in the series too. You know, I mean, Embiid took to the podium and kind of said that midway through the series. And I mean, Brett Brown needs to start laying the groundwork for that in like February. You know, he's a bigger guy. He needs to be officiated differently. He's out there getting pounded. I mean, they need to be taking fines left and right to kind of protect Embiid and to ensure that, you know, he can get to the line just every single night, because when he didn't have that, his overall offensive efficiency definitely came back to earth. And by the way, this whole Tristan Thompson comp for Ben Simmons, look, if Tristan Thompson had Magic Johnson's vision and, you know, a quality above average handle, I'd like Tristan Thompson.
No,
too,
look,
okay?
I'm only throwing that out there as a comp for the shot. It's just like, if you have to break everything down and start over, it's probably not going to end well. There just aren't many examples of that. I mean, Kawhi was so much further along than Ben Simmons is right now. LeBron, same deal. And it just, it kind of freaks me out. And I think, especially at the highest levels of the league, like, the Celtics aren't going away. Simmons is going to have to figure out a way to make this work. And it's not going to be as easy as I think everyone thought it was 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever thought it was going to be easy for him to get his shot, just to put it together. But let me ask you this. Does he have a chance to be the best non-shooter in NBA history?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, Shaq was a non-shooter and was pretty incredible. So I think that's going to be tough.
Like, let me put an asterisk. Okay, best non-shooting ball handler, right? Like, I mean,
yes.
I think that's possible for him. So I think he's going to be really, really good. And I think you could be a Hall of Famer as the NBA's best all-time non-shooting ball handler. I think that's possible.
Okay. Moving on here, one more Sixers-Celtics question from Leon, who says, This Celtics team has been so much fun, and that Sixers series brought out the worst Boston sports fan impulses inside me. Despite listening to Rights to Ricky Sanchez after Celtics wins this past week, make me a bad person. First of all, it does not make you a bad person. That's part of the magic of the playoffs, is that we all become terrible, terrible people. I want to say, though, I was surprised by the restraint from Boston fans in the past week. This was a series that could have led to a lot of unbearable Celtics myth-making and a lot of like Celtics shit-talking to Sixers fans, and they mostly toned it down, which I think is a reflection of the fear they had of the Sixers, but it wasn't as bad as I expected it to be.
I guess. I don't know, man. We got a lot of emails. There was a lot of days I was waking up looking at openfloormail@gmail.com saying, I don't want to really read these. But do you think part of it is they still remember what happened in last year's conference finals?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. And I also think that they were looking at this team, and even Celtics fans didn't really think that they were going to do it. So they were just sort of treading carefully here. But it's funny. Like, look, this series, it was... No matter what happened, we were going to be bombarded with ridiculousness. Like, if Boston wins, we're hearing nonstop talk about Al Horford and Marcus Smart. And if the Sixers were going to win, it was going to guarantee us another 3 months of Sam Hinkie lectures. So there were really no good outcomes for, like, neutral observers. But I will say, the basketball was fun as hell.
Yeah, I mean, the basketball was all right. I probably would have preferred, you know, Jazz Pelicans or something like that, you know, in a 1-16 format. But whatever, it was a good series, and I am very excited to see the conference finals and to see if LeBron is going to be able to sort of do the deja vu thing he did, you know, in terms of, you know, back to back sweeping of the Raptors and then just back to back thumping of the Celtics. I mean, it does have that kind of feeling, though, doesn't it? Because, like, Isaiah wasn't right, you know, a year ago, kind of coming into that series. Like, what's going on? You know, Kyrie's not out there, obviously, this year for Boston, but you know, they still have other talent on the court. They play hard. It's the same underdog spirit, you know, Marcus Smart, all this hype. It does very much feel like, you know, we're in a time machine, you know, 12 months later.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally, if that's your read on the series or if that's anyone's read on the series, like, that is completely fair. I just think that this Celtics team is kind of in a zone right now that is hard to explain, and it's going to give them a better shot than some people might realize. And also, just from a structural standpoint, they are so much better positioned to guard LeBron this year than they were a year ago. I mean, like, Avery Bradley is great. I'm an Avery Bradley guy to the bitter end. I loved Isaiah Thomas, but, like, that backcourt was always going to be completely screwed against Cleveland. And I think now, you know, everyone is, instead of 6'3", everyone is 6'8", and that is going to make a difference.
So you think what you're saying, if I'm reading between the lines, is that Jason Tatum's going to be the LeBron stopper and it's a whole different ballgame?
No, you know what I think they're going to do is throw Marcus Morris on LeBron. And as someone who has watched a lot of Morris twins in my time, probably too much, I think he can be effective. And Markieff can slow down LeBron sometimes. It's that body type is your best shot. Obviously, LeBron's going to get 35 regardless, but, like, Marcus Morris will have a decent shot at slowing him down. And then you can mix in a little Horford, mix in Jaylen Brown, mix in Jason Tatum. And I think the combination is tougher defense than LeBron will see this side of Draymond.
Yeah, do you think that Kevin Love, I mean, this may be the most obvious question ever, but is he the X factor of this series? Like, if he's playing like he did against Toronto in terms of, you know, being able to get his shot and even, you know, score some little down low too, I mean, is that what puts Cleveland in the driver's seat? Or are you picking the Celtics? I can't tell based on how you're hedging right now which way you're leaning.
I've really, really liked watching this Celtics team, man. I don't know. So I feel bad. I'm picking LeBron out of fear and respect for what he's done. And I also, as much as I've enjoyed this Celtics team, the thought of them making the finals without Kyrie and Hayward it's too much for me to bear. So we can't let this get too far out of control. but I think it's going to go 6 and maybe 7.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm giving them two wins. I think they're going to probably start the series pretty well. I do worry a little bit just because LeBron's had some rest time here, and we called it though. He bamboozled everyone with that whole "I'm burnt" talk after Game 7.
Totally. I called it.
I mean, we kind of sniffed that one out, but now he's actually rested. He knows this opponent. He's played them before. I think there is some psychological edge in terms of, you know, last year, you know, that's going to be on their minds one way or another. Now, maybe for a guy like, you know, Tatum or someone else, that's not a factor. But, you know, for Horford, I would assume it would be. I mean, those guys have faced a lot in the playoffs, and Horford's just never had an answer for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, Stevens was already, you know, sounding really stressed out about LeBron after Game 5. You know, 10 minutes after they win, he's already like, oh, my God, LeBron is ridiculous. What are we going to do? So, you know, I think you're smart to pick LeBron, but yeah, we'll see. I mean, it would be one of the bigger upsets. Like, you kept asking me, oh, how big of an upset would this be left or right? I mean, if Boston shocks the world and takes down Cleveland, it ends LeBron's final streak with this squad. That is one of the biggest upsets probably in the last, you know, 10 years of the playoffs at least.
For sure. And it's funny. The LeBron thing, I've enjoyed it, but he is very much in every interview he gives, he like plays the kind of beleaguered uncle, or really like the Danny Glover Lethal Weapon role, where he's just too old for this shit and he's like ready to, I don't know. He's just been in that mode all year publicly. And then you watch him play and you're like, you look like you're 29 years old. You look like you're going to be playing 25 years in the league. Like, Bron Jr. is going to play 10 years before you retire. And so I don't buy anything with LeBron. And as far as the upset, or you mentioned X factors, I think the X factor isn't really Kevin Love, because I don't think that he's going to give them as much in this series. I think the guy to watch, though, is going to be George Hill, because since he's come back, they've looked like a different team, and he looks healthy, and it wasn't totally explained what was wrong with him. And like even in that Game 7, he didn't play in the first half for some reason. So I don't really know what the deal is with George Hill, but when he's out there, they are pretty good. And if you take him off the court, then I think Boston really does have a chance.
Now, he was really, really good at times in that Toronto series. There was a few times going to the basket where he looked like he had a jetpack on. And I was like, this guy, he's not just like fast for George Hill. He's like fast, you know? And so it's like, give me that kind of back problem. I'll take that.
Yeah.
But I think Love represents an interesting challenge for Boston, just because he's more comfortable, you know, playing the way that they play. He's, you know, going to be... It's a cleaner matchup, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, compared to like the Valanciunas factor or the Embiid factor in the previous series. So I guess I'm circling what he's able to get done against Boston and vice versa. You know, when I'm looking at this, because I don't think Boston's got an answer to LeBron. Sorry, no offense, Marcus Morris. I don't see that. I mean, that sounds like
that might be quick... the craziest shit I've said on the podcast all year, and I apologize to everyone.
Well, I'm trying to be nice and let it slide, but I think that there's going to be some foul trouble involved if that's their game plan on LeBron. But like I said, I'm looking forward to seeing it. And the one other thing that I'm watching in this series, definitely the meme wars, because you had the Scary Terry t-shirt, you had Drew Bledsoe and everything he was doing. But then also on the other end, you've got LeBron wearing Seagram's hats to post-game press conferences and just carrying himself like he really does own Toronto. I mean, he was wearing like a Toronto-based t-shirt at one of his press conferences. Just all these like subtle but not actually subtle jabs at the Raptors throughout that series. Not to mention he was, you know, making his body a meme on the court by shooting turnaround jumper after turnaround jumper after turnaround jumper. So Boston here has entered with a little bit of cockiness in terms of, you know, the t-shirts and all that stuff. You know, does that dry up when you run into LeBron, or do we get like the secondary meme war going on off the court to kind of complement the on-court action? I'm certainly looking for that in the Eastern Conference, much like I'm really looking forward to whatever Draymond has to say in the Western Conference, because it seems pretty personal to him. Like he's just had a lot of daggers for Houston here over the last 9 months.
Yeah.
And I expect him to really just, you know, walk into that one head first too.
Well, we'll see. I can't wait for more Terry Rozier shirts. That's going to be my first stop in Boston, is find whoever is selling the bootleg Scary Terry t-shirts. I'm all over it. But it should be fun. We didn't get to questions about Marcus Smart. For the record, I think the Celtics are going to pay Marcus Smart this summer because they're going to need his salary if they want to make a trade for an Anthony Davis type guy. They need someone who's making $10 or $12 million. And we didn't get to more questions on Jason, 12-time Tatum. Tatum has been unbelievable. But look, man, bottom line is, I am just really, really excited for these conference finals. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to Boston on Sunday, and you will be in Houston, I believe, on Monday. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, it should be great. You know, I think we'll figure out some sort of pod schedule for next week, but it should be fun. Thank you, everyone who has listened thus far, and let's come back next week.
Yeah, guys, go ahead and email all questions, comments, concerns, you know, trash talk, meme wars, flame wars, whatever you've got, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. And it doesn't just have to be conference finals related, because we realize 26 teams are sitting at home, and a bunch of them are preparing for the lottery drawing here right around the corner. If you've got lottery questions, draft-related, you know, suggestions, trade scenarios, whatever, we would love to hear it. Also, don't forget, go to Apple Podcasts, search Open Floor, two words, very easy to spell. Find our page, scroll down, see where it says rate and review, tap 5 stars. We really, really appreciate it. Now, Andrew, you know, sorry to Mrs. Sharp that you're not going to be there with her for Mother's Day, but don't forget, grab her that Buffalo Wild Wings gift card. You will be Son of the Year. Andrew will have $5 for free. Andrew, until next week, you know, have fun in Boston. I'll talk to you.
All right, man. Get ready for the Rodney Hood game. It's coming.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.